Dean Slyter has taught meditation since 1970. He's also worked as a film critic, so it's only natural that Slyter would combine these two interests to write a book called Cinema Nirvana, Enlightenment Lessons from the Movies. Slyter gave Steve Paulson a few examples of Cinema Nirvana, starting with Steven Spielberg's 1975 classic, Jaws.
I look at Jaws from the shark's point of view, which, in fact, I think Spielberg very emphatically wants us to do. Think back, what's the very first shot in Jaws? It's a good question to ask people. Usually they'll say, oh, the pretty blonde girl is swimming, but before that, there's the bonfire, the drunken party on the beach. And before that, the opening shot that runs under the credits is a shark's eye view shot where the camera, as if looking out through the eyes of the shark, is cruising a few feet above the ocean floor through all the schools of minnows and the seaweeds, clearly looking for something to eat. So from the shark's point of view, it's a movie about hunger. And so I see this as the insatiable hunger of the self. Now, Buddhist teaching is that the self is bottomlessly, insatiably hungry because ultimately it doesn't exist. This is what's called the doctrine of anatta, which is one of the fundamental doctrines of Buddhist teaching. That the closer we look for a self, you know, you ask a person, do you have a self? They'll say, sure. You say, where is it? And they might point to their head or they might point to their chest. But if we start to look more closely, the closer we look for, well, where exactly you're pointing to your head? Is the self in your behind your left eye or behind your right ear or where is it? The closer we look for a self, the more it sort of deconstructs. Ultimately, we start to see that where we thought there was a self, there's really sort of empty space, boundless sky-like space.
So there's no self at all?
Well, the short answer is there's no self at all. There's a longer answer, too, where the philosophy starts getting very subtle. There's a self that functions, but when we look for it existentially as a as an independently existing, substantial a thing, an object, something chunky, it deconstructs. It turns out there's a bottomless, as we say, emptiness to it. Now, looking at it philosophically that way may seem difficult, but if we look at it more in terms of our day-to-day experience, don't we all have this hunger, this feeling that there's something that I need that's going to fulfill me? When we were little, it was, Mommy, Mommy, please buy me the Barbie doll, or please buy me the G.I. Joe. That would be it. Then I'll never ask for another thing.
So if the shark is insatiable, it's this insatiable hunger for the self, does that mean we have to kill the shark?
The illusion of self is what needs to be destroyed. And so what we get is our three hunters, right? We get the Richard Dreyfuss character, who is Hooper, the shark expert. We get the Robert Shaw character, Captain Quint, the leathery, nail-spitting captain, the Ahab character. And then we get Chief of Police Brody, played by Roy Scheider. Now, these three hunters, first of all, it's very interesting. There's a complete illogicality here because the shark has been terrorizing bathers. In other words, it's been eating people close in, right off of the beach. Where do these guys go to hunt the shark in the whole middle and final section of the film? They go out into the deep waters where they're out of sight of land. It's completely illogical, and yet nobody ever notices that.
But of course, you have to do that in movie terms because they are more at risk out there. They're in the element of the shark.
That's exactly right. So even though it's logically incorrect, it's dramatically correct, and it's, I would say, it's dharmically correct in terms of the metaphysical quest. In order to really confront the self and deal with it, you have to go into the deep waters of life.
Well, another one of the movies that you talk about, well, it's a classic of film history, The Graduate, one of those great movies from the 60s. What's the spirituality there?
The film starts with the hero getting off the plane at LA International Airport to the strains of Simon and Garfunkel as he travels along the conveyor belt with the mechanical voice behind him saying, you know, stay to the right or whatever it is.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping.
with that wonderful blank kind of Buster Keaton visage that Dustin Hoffman wears on his face, we get the feeling that he is feeling himself as being part of a machine. You remember that early in the film at the big party celebrating his graduation from college, one of his family friends pulls him over by the side of the pool to give him one great word of advice, the famous word,
plastics.
Right. The secret of the world, where riches are to be made.
Exactly.
Exactly, how do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said, that's a deal.
And of course, that word embodies everything that he is regarding with horror. The idea that the world, the adult world he's about to enter into, is a world that is synthetic, where everything is prefabricated, where everything is inauthentic. A few minutes earlier, he's upstairs in his room. He's reluctant to come downstairs for the party, and his father comes up to get him and asks him what's wrong. He says, I'm worried about my future.
What about it?
I don't know. I want it to be...
To be what?
Different.
Now, what's never defined in the film is different from what. But when he comes downstairs and we see the whole kind of upper middle class nightmare of tinkling cocktail glasses and people making small talk and his mother proudly reading all of his accomplishments out of the college yearbook.
Associate editor of the college newspaper in his junior year, managing editor in his senior.
We realize different from this. You know, in adolescence, we're in this strange in-between period, in between childhood and adulthood, where our life isn't formed yet. We're in a kind of a shapelessness. There's a kind of a freedom that we catch a glimpse of, which is very much analogous to what we have according to Buddhist teaching, particularly Tibetan Buddhist teaching, in what's called the bardo, the in-between stage between death and one's next birth, where you catch a glimpse of that total formlessness of freedom, of nirvana. And then for most people, if they don't know how to just abide in nirvana, then they enter another room and they're born again and they're stuck once again on the wheel of samsara, of, you know, humdrum everyday life. So adolescence is sort of like that. We catch a glimpse of freedom. And this, I think, is why teenagers are famous for all kinds of sarcastic conversation and obnoxious behavior. And they're just trying to have that freedom as thoroughly as they can and try to hold at bay the ambassadors of the world of samsara, which are the adults telling them, you've got to get a job, you've got to get the graduate degree, and so forth.
Now, I've been saving maybe the best movie for last, The Godfather. Where do you find cinema nirvana in that?
Well, I find it, first of all, in the title. I think The Godfather is a contemplation of God the Father. I think that it is Francis Ford Coppola, who grew up in a strongly Catholic family. I believe it is his sort of last-ditch attempt to come to terms with a traditional monotheistic patriarchal God, which, of course, is embodied in Vito Corleone, the Marlon Brando character, who is seen as this sort of benevolent despot who has the power of life and death over everyone.
And the thing that's interesting about that character is he, as you say, he is benevolent. He's not just brutal. He's not just killing people left and right. He does, in his own way, have a very finely tuned sense of justice when it's right to kill.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we see that measured sense of justice at the beginning of the film when Bonacera, the undertaker, asks him to have the men who raped his daughter, raped and I think they cut up her face, he wants them killed. And he says, no, your daughter was not killed. But he's going to have them, he's going to have some very painful things done to them. But when he gives the order, he tells his man,
Give this to Clemenza. I'm unreliable people, people that aren't going to be carried away. I mean, we're not murderers, in spite of what this undertaker says.
So we see that finely tuned sense of justice.
So where does Michael Corleone then fit into this? I mean, the Al Pacino character who eventually does take over the family business, who it seemed was this nice boy, the nice educated boy who was the last one who was going to get into the dirty business of killing and running the mob.
That's exactly right. He was the one who was going to always be kept out of the family business. So it's almost fated from the beginning that Michael is going to inherit the family business. The question is whether in the process of doing that, he can convert the situation. And that is where Kay comes in, the Diane Keaton character. Very important character. She actually is our way into the film. She's the character we identify with. She's the outsider who gets involved with the family.
Yes, and the Diane Keaton character loses out. I mean, her worldview cannot withstand the pressures of the family.
Right, and the film ends literally with the door being closed in her face. So she really represents, in Jungian terms, the anima, the feminine, compassionate, loving side of each one of us. So the question really is, can the anima be successfully integrated or incorporated into this patriarchal church? And the answer that the film seems to give is no, it can't.
Dean Slyter is the author of Cinema Nirvana, Enlightenment Lessons from the Movies. He spoke with Steve Paulson.